Number two, last month I gave a warning about the mushrooming activities of the Soviet KGB in Quebec Province, Canada. Soviet bloc aircraft, including camouflaged Soviet troop transports, have been passing through the Mirabel and Dorval airports in Montreal in large numbers. As of last month, I was able to reveal the existence of at least 12 guerrilla camps in Quebec Province and over 3,000 KGB-trained personnel in Canada. Today, I can tell you more. The things I was able to tell you about last month are part of a much bigger picture involving France, the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union in a complex power play. But the bottom line is that the Kremlin is already making preparations for the invasion of the United States that is to follow the initial surprise nuclear attack. As always, the chess players in the Kremlin are planning their moves in sequence and far in advance. We are hearing a great deal today about the separatist movement in Quebec Province. But in fact, Quebec is being planned behind the scenes to be no more than a pilot project for all of Canada, which is intended ultimately to go the way of Quebec. In all this, the matter of language, French versus English, is only a superficial ploy or cover for the much more serious issues underneath. Years ago, France saw the handwriting on the wall for Europe, given the domination of the NATO alliance by double-crossing rulers in the United States. So France pulled out of NATO to go her own way, while quietly coming to terms with the Soviet Union in certain areas. Today, there's a quid pro quo between France and the Soviet Union with respect to Canada. The Soviet Union is desirous of using Canada as a base for military operations against the United States and has induced France to provide entree to Canada through Quebec Province for this purpose. Even though Quebec is part of Canada and therefore nominally in the British fold, French influence there is very powerful. The inducements held out by the Soviet Union to persuade France to cooperate in this venture include both the carrot and the stick. The carrot is the prospect for France to expand her influence over all of Canada at the expense of her old rival, Great Britain. But the stick over France's head is the threat that if she doesn't play ball, the increasingly powerful French Communist Party will take over and end the existence of the French government as we know it. And so far, France is going along. And for that reason, Moscow called off her dogs in the recent French election. That's why the French communists behaved so strangely, wrecking the socialist-communist coalition and causing the leftist coalition to lose the election when they looked like sure winners to many. Within Canada itself, all this is cemented by an element at the highest levels of the government. This element is working actively toward the goal of French-speaking Marxist République Populaire du Canada, People's Republic of Canada. This powerful faction in the Canadian government is not only cooperating with France in permitting Soviet entree through Quebec, but has also negotiated secret arrangements directly with the Soviet Union as long as 2 years ago. As a result, Soviet personnel infiltrated into Canada through Quebec Province are fanning out all across Canada. There remains another important segment of the Canadian government who are not party to the Soviet-French intrigues now underway, who instead are pro-Canadian, pro-Britain, and generally pro-American. It is they who have been responsible for the efforts in Canada to stem the tide of Soviet activities there, ranging from nuclear sabotage operations into the United States last spring and summer, to the recent sensational spy case. But this loyal segment is now losing influence relative to the faction who are party to the Soviet-French intrigues. This is due in large part to the self-destructive, weak behavior of the United States since the summer of 1976. Most of all, the total lack of effort by the United States to defend itself against mounting nuclear sabotage starting last spring has strengthened the hand of all those who say the United States is done for and deserves no further help. So now, the Soviet Union is preparing already for the invasion of the United States. A joint operation by the KGB and the Soviet Army is now underway in Canada and in Mexico as well, although my reports there are more fragmentary so far. In the summer of 1976, the Soviet Union began planting underwater missiles in our own territorial waters in preparation for a nuclear surprise attack. The strategy was to strike from inside our defenses, from short range that would afford us no warning time. Now the Soviet Army is embarking on a parallel strategy of preparation for attack when the moment comes. The Soviet Army is today the best equipped and best trained in the world, able to fight nuclear, conventional, or chemical warfare. Day in and day out, we hear about the threat the Soviet Army, backing up the other forces of the Warsaw Pact, poses to Western Europe. But, my friends, the Soviet Army is not interested in Western Europe, because Moscow has already become the de facto capital of Europe. NATO is in shreds, and Europeans have had enough of fighting wars generation after generation. Most of all, they see no hope in the direction of the United States. We have double-crossed, stranded, and sold out other allies too many times. And the controlled Carter administration is confirming that Europe, too, is expendable. Instead of Europe, the United States is the prime target now for the Soviet Army. While we have our military forces deployed at presumed frontline positions worldwide, the Soviet Army is now in the process of camping on our own doorstep in Canada and Mexico. Squads of Soviet troops are fanning out all over Canada to pre-assigned waiting stations, which are separated from one another in most cases by at least 5 miles. As of my latest report on March 27, 2 days ago, Soviet squads had begun reaching waiting stations in every Canadian province except the Yukon. By the time you hear this report, squads will be there too. The heaviest concentrations of these Soviet troop squads is in southern Canada, near the United States border, especially in Quebec, British Columbia, New Brunswick, and Alberta. Otherwise, they are dispersing thinly throughout Canada. Right now, the task of the Soviet troops is simply to reach their dispersed waiting stations, mostly in rugged or remote areas, establish themselves there in ways that do not attract attention, and just wait. They are to maintain themselves and wait however long is required, weeks, months, or longer, until they receive orders to start preparing for an offensive. Only then will the widely dispersed Soviet troops gather up their caches of arms, which include tactical neutron bombs, and start forming up into combat formations. Literally overnight, the previously invisible Soviet Army in Canada and in Mexico will suddenly become visible as a massive fighting force that is ready to invade the United States. Just as the Soviet Navy has done with its underwater missiles, the Soviet Army is now in the process of positioning itself inside our main lines of defense. If all goes according to plan, And if this operation is allowed to proceed, like the other Soviet activities against America, the 140,000 combat-ready American troops, now secretly stationed near our border with Canada, will be surprised and overwhelmed. And the battle for North America, like the Battle of the Harvest Moon 6 months ago, will go to the Soviet Union. Topic number three. I have pointed out in the recent past that nowadays wars are planned. They do not happen by accident. Those who are entrusted with our national security always include an inner circle who, doing the bidding of our secret rulers, know when war is coming, because they themselves are helping to bring it about. But even as we are being set up for another round of needless suffering, waste, and carnage, we who are intended to be sacrificed are always kept in the dark about what is really going on, always in the name of national security. The instinct for cover-up by our secret rulers is always powerful. But nowadays, it is even more rampant, because they are now trying to hide terrible mistakes and failures on their own part. Nowhere is this more true than in the military environment now dominated by Soviet cosmo-strategy. Take Skylab, for example, which is fast becoming the Fort Knox scandal of space. Like the alleged tremendous United States gold hoard at Fort Knox, the 85-ton American space station known as Skylab no longer exists. As I reported last October in Audio Letter 27, Skylab was blasted out of the sky on October 18, 1977 by a Soviet Cosmos interceptor, that is, a killer satellite. The Cosmos interceptor fired its charged particle beam weapon at Skylab, and Skylab erupted into an enormous fireball that was seen all the way from southwest Texas to points perhaps 800 miles away in Arkansas and Missouri. 9 days later, the cover-up began. Suddenly, NASA released a cover story to the effect that for some reason, Skylab was sinking out of orbit years earlier than expected. And since that time, the story has been revived periodically, each time with a little more pessimism about the chances of saving Skylab. Just as was done in the Fort Knox gold swindle, much ado is being made about something that does not exist, purely to fool the public. At Fort Knox in September 1974, a small single compartment of strangely reddish junk gold was shown a delegation of visitors, no gold experts among them, and the United States Treasury Department then proclaimed, "See, it's all here." And today, stories about Skylab are accompanied on television by file film and in print by photographs of Skylab to reinforce the assumption that Skylab is still up there. Now, even the bogus gold audit, so-called, has its parallel in the Skylab cover-up. The Martin Marietta Company, which is controlled by our secret rulers, has been given a 9-month contract to spend $125,000 of American taxpayers' money to study the Skylab situation. Can you imagine? And what next? At Fort Knox, the Treasury argued that it would be too costly to perform a gold inventory that would answer conclusively my charges about deficiencies in the gold supply, even though such an inventory had been carried out 20 years earlier without difficulty in only 9 weeks. So don't be too surprised if one of these days NASA should announce, with deep regret, of course, that budgetary factors will make it impossible to carry out a Skylab rescue mission. But more serious than the Skylab cover-up Is the frantic cover-up efforts by the government of the Soviet cosmospheres now floating over the United States and elsewhere worldwide? These are the very devices General Thomas Power was concerned about so long ago. They are armed with charged particle beam weapons, which can do chores like destroying our ICBMs in their silos. They can also shoot military or other aircraft out of the sky, such as the Air India Boeing 747 that was blasted out of the sky early in January by a cosmosphere near Bombay. But so far, they have been used over the United States primarily in a weather modification role. For this purpose, the cosmospheres fire their particle beams in a defocused mode, causing the beam to be absorbed in the atmosphere instead of penetrating all the way to a target on the ground. In this way, the cosmospheres are able to alter drastically the electrical charges in the upper atmosphere, which in turn strongly influence our weather. Many decades ago, the electrical wizard Nikola Tesla predicted that weather control would someday be possible by altering these electrical charges. Now, with the aid of their particle beam weapons, the Soviet Union has proven him right, thanks to the tremendous energy release achieved by particle beams. This energy is only a tiny fraction of the total energy contained in a large winter storm, for example, but it serves to trigger and guide these storms. As a byproduct of firing their particle beam weapons in this defocused mode for weather control, the cosmospheres create tremendous air shocks or airquakes. These first began to be heard up and down the east coast of the United States on December 2, 1977, as Soviet Cosmosphere No. 1 in the list I revealed that month began firing. Cosmosphere No. 1 was floating at that time off the South Carolina coast. Thousands of people from South Carolina to Connecticut were frightened by the powerful rumbling blasts rolling in from the ocean, and windows and dishes were shattered in some areas. More recently, as I pointed out last month, these earthquakes have also been heard elsewhere than along the East Coast, but no national publicity has been allowed to leak out about these other earthquakes. Meanwhile, events in the Middle East are careening along ever faster toward war. The long-planned limited nuclear strike from the Sinai against Arab OPEC oil wells, which I first warned about in audio letters 5 and 6 in the fall of 1975, is fast approaching. The principal target in this strike is to be Saudi Arabia, and for that reason the Rockefellers arranged to sell the oil fields back to Saudi Arabia, thereby saving their own money nearly 2 years ago. Saudi Arabia has never participated directly in any of the past Middle East conflicts, but now a relentless propaganda campaign is underway to paint Saudi Arabia as a major threat to Israel. United States senators are beginning to spout the line that it is actually Saudi Arabia that is the source of support for Israel's bitter enemy, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the fighting arm of Al-Fatah. Meanwhile, for more than a year, Israeli fighter bombers have been secretly carrying out practice raids against a Saudi fighter base at Tabuk, deep inside the northwest corner of Saudi Arabia. As a result, Saudi Arabia is becoming increasingly eager to obtain American F-15 fighters, or if not F-15s, then Mirage F-1s from France, to match the Israeli presence in the air. And in turn, a new Senate report has emerged which says that if we do sell F-15s to Saudi Arabia as part of the Carter administration's so-called package deal, Israel may well feel so threatened as to mount a preemptive strike against Saudi Arabia. In all of this, both Israel and Saudi Arabia are being treated as expendable pawns by our own secret rulers. A cutoff of Middle East oil supplies, precipitating a national emergency, and dictatorial controls in the United States is still part of the objective, just as it was in the original plan 2.5 years ago. But now, Faced with the catastrophic shift in the military power balance toward the Soviet Union during the past 6 months, our rulers view the coming nuclear doom of OPEC as a scorched earth policy. That is, the oil riches of the Middle East are to be denied to the Soviets by capping off the oil wells with deadly radioactivity. After this is accomplished, by an American strike from the Sinai, disguised as an Israeli raid, Israel will be abandoned to fend for itself. But regardless of the wishful thinking of our secret rulers, these maneuverings and intrigues are not lost on the Kremlin. Three large Israeli Air Force bases have been built in the occupied Sinai with United States funds. One at the Eytam, E-Y-T-A-M, near El Arish, on the Mediterranean coast. One at Ophira, O-F-I-R-A, near the southern tip of the Sinai. And one at Etzion, E-T-Z-I-O-N, 15 miles southwest of the Israeli port of Eilat on the Gulf of Aqaba. Etzion alone cost over $4 billion and can handle the most advanced aircraft. Seemingly, this would provide decisive control of the area. But floating over the Sinai now are five Soviet cosmospheres. And there are 10 more over and around Israel. One over northwest Saudi Arabia, between the Etzion Air Base in the Sinai and Tabuk, the Saudi Arabian Air Force Base. Four over western Jordan, ranged along Israel's east border. One over southwestern Syria, near the Sea of Galilee. One over a spot about 10 miles offshore, near Etam Air Base. Another about 10 miles offshore, midway between Haifa and Tel Aviv. And two over Israel itself, one in the north and one in the south. They are all at an altitude of only 12 miles, except the two over the Mediterranean Sea, which are only 7 miles high. In addition, four undersea cobalt bombs for earthquake and tidal wave generation have been planted at distances from 40 to 60 miles offshore in an arc from southern Lebanon to north of the Sinai. They threaten Haifa, Tel Aviv, and the entire Israeli coast. It's clear that the Soviet Union has no intention of allowing any military action to take place in the Middle East that is not to Soviet advantage. For example, the cosmospheres could stop any Israeli or American strike against Saudi Arabia in its tracks, if desired. Or if that strike will help in the Kremlin campaign to mobilize the Russian people for war, they might sit by, watch the nuclear strike take place, and then destroy the planes on their way back to the Sinai. Anything can happen. Meanwhile, the erratic behavior of the controlled Carter administration and of Jimmy Carter himself is being turned to the advantage of the Kremlin. Less than 2 weeks ago, on March 17, 1978, Jimmy Carter gave a major foreign policy speech at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It has been widely described as a tough talk, even though his threats had to do with little more than cutting back on economic and scientific cooperation with Russia. But the tone of the speech was perfect for internal Soviet propaganda purposes. Immediately, the Carter speech was seized upon to fuel a fast-growing Kremlin campaign to convince the Russian people of an American threat so that they will support nuclear war when it comes. Then 2 days ago, on March 27, 1978, the Kremlin unleashed a new ultimatum to the controlled Carter administration to accept a SALT II surrender treaty. It was 6 months to the day after Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko had delivered the first SALT II ultimatum on the basis of America's loss of the Battle of the Harvest Moon. This time, the ultimatum was delivered in Pravda, the official organ of the Soviet Communist Party. The Pravda article urged the United States to make up its mind quickly on whether or not it wants a new agreement on strategic arms limitation. American rejection of the new agreement according to the Pravda ultimatum, would, quote, torpedo international security, unquote. My friends, it's been said by some that Jimmy Carter is the last United States president with a chance to make decisions that will prevent the loss of American freedom. But that's not really true. Jimmy Carter is fast hammering nails in our coffin, but it was Gerald Ford who, as president, failed America at the most crucial point in our history. In Audio Letter 17 in October 1976, I revealed in detail how President Ford knuckled under to squalid threats of a personal financial scandal and agreed to the treasonous Red Friday Agreement on October 1, 1976. In so doing, he undid the go-ahead he had given General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to remove and continue removing the Soviet underwater missiles in our territorial waters. The Soviet rulers reached a profoundly important evaluation of the United States at that point. They had tried to surprise the United States in a double cross and nuclear attack. They had been caught, tripped up by public exposure through my tapes, limited though that exposure was. And yet, they had ended up paying nothing for their failure. Instead, their former secret allies wanted to reinstate the former secret alliance as if nothing had happened, even to the extent of permitting underwater missiles to be planted along our shores thereafter without interference. And so the Soviet Union concluded that it might as well pull out all the stops in preparing to destroy America once and for all, because those who rule America behind the scenes had become so decadent and weak that they had lost touch with reality. The Anglo-Saxon West was ready to lie down and die. What a shame. What a tragedy. My friends, the actions of the controlled Carter administration are leading us ever deeper into quicksand, and by military power alone, there is no hope that America can be saved. Nor is there any hope that our present leaders, elected and otherwise, will snap out of a lifetime of deception, double-dealing, lies and blackmail and truly act in the West's best interest. The only hope, my friends, is for the American people to turn back to our Lord Jesus Christ, to throw out and punish those who are leading us to slaughter, and to pray that God in His mercy will turn away the plans of the Soviet Union to destroy us together with our evil rulers. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.